election. You know, I suppose it's possible that the House, with its new majority, could decide that they want to think twice about what this lame duck session did. And we also know that there's now a trial date that's set for mid-January before the Senate. You know, it's my hope that if at the end of the day that trial does go forward, which, you know, would be a further waste of everybody's time and resources, a distraction that simply moves Larry away from the job that the voters have twice put him in office resoundingly to carry out. You know, it's my hope that if that does still go forward, that, you know, the supermajority that's required of the state Senate does not vote to remove this duly elected official from office. And I fully expect that they would not, but you know, you never know what can happen. And I really think it would be tragic if we do see this go forward to trial, and even more tragic if at the end of the day there were a decision made that somehow this justified the removal of a duly elected district attorney.
So stay tuned. I've been speaking with Miriam Krinsky, Executive Director of Fair and Just Prosecution. Miriam, thank you so much. We will all be watching the Pennsylvania Senate in mid-January. Thank you so much. You have been listening to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineers.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on Monday, December 19th at 6 p.m., This month's board meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found at our website at kboo.fm.
KBOO's end of the year drive is happening right now. We invite you to become a member today by going to kboo.fm/give. Or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. Contribute now and help us meet our $70,000 goal by the end of the year. Join the KBOO family today at kboo.fm/give.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out, so make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the streets.
Oh, what a world. KBOO 90.7. Dasha T said that.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. It is big news. WNBA player, somebody who is well known and who we've talked about over the past 9 months, Brittany Griner, who is imprisoned in Russia, in a Russian gulag, for 10 years for having traces of marijuana on her, has now been set free. And to give us the details is one of our favorite go-to people when it comes to sports and politics. It is Dave Zirin. He is a columnist for The Nation, Edge of Sports. He is also the co-host of a radio show called The Collision, the intersection of sports and politics, with him and former NBA great Etan Thomas. So welcome to the show, Dave. I know a lot of people have been hitting you up left and right. I'm glad we caught you. Let everybody know what is happening with Brittany Griner. What is happening with her? What do we need to know?
Well, what we need to know is that by the time people are hearing this broadcast, her feet may have already touched down on U.S. soil. It's supposed to happen, as you and I are having this conversation, in the next 20 hours or so. And this has all happened, I think, because of agitation led by Brittany Griner's wife, Sherelle, to make sure that Brittany Griner's name was in the consciousness, that it was at the top of the list for the activities of the State Department right now. Anthony Blinken, Joe Biden, like, free Brittany. And that also raised awareness about Paul Whelan, who's a former Marine who's also in this hell out there. And as you rightly described it, Gulag, Mordovia, the land of prisons, as it's known. That's where Brittany Griner is going to have to live the next decade of her life. But now there's going to be an exchange, a prisoner swap, finally, where the United States, in return for Brittany Griner, and it is crazy to talk about people like they're objects in this way, but in return for Brittany Griner, an arms dealer who's known as the Merchant of Death, named Victor Boot. Now, of course, the right wing is already losing their minds over this trade. but I mean, to me, it's as simple as this. Victor Boot was due to be freed by 2029 anyway, at the latest. Like, is 7 years of Brittany Griner's freedom worth 7 years of Victor Boot's? And if you think about it like that, I think the move is and the trade is an obvious one.
Dave Zirin, you know, I heard people make this argument, and I was really surprised to see some black folks making this as well, understanding the history of these United States. You know, the argument went, well, you know, we're trading her for an arms dealer, as if the United States is not the biggest arms dealer in the world, as if we didn't have 600 mass shootings in these United States this year alone, with no intention of manufacturers and advocates of guns to scale back, stop manufacturing, or to even punish people who are irresponsible with their guns in terms of how they market them and how they distribute them. That's point one. The fact that these United States have not been involved in regime changes, have not been involved with shipping arms all around the planet to make sure that governments who we disagree with were overthrown. So it seemed like a bit of a hypocrisy when we start talking about, well, he's the Merchant of Death, when arguably we're the biggest merchant of death.
We're the merchant of death. We're the pirate ship of death. Although that's too negative on pirate ships, which were pretty cool. But the other part of this, too, is that Victor Boot was an arms dealer for client regimes of the United States as well. It's like trying to paint him as some kind of enemy of the United States if Victor Boot ever really wants to open his mouth and talk about what he's done. I mean, it's going to not look good for the U.S. I mean, that's one of the reasons why they threw him in this hole. And it's just so crazy. Like, I've been reading a lot about his arrest. And he's arrested on the charge of conspiring to kill Americans by selling arms to the FARC, which is the rebel group of Colombia, who, to my knowledge, never had a perspective on killing Americans. Whatever one might think of the FARC. And it's just a very bizarre story of them arresting this guy who has a lot of secrets, and which would in turn make him valuable to the Russian state. So it's dirty business wherever you look. You know, this is not a clean trade by any stretch of the imagination, because everybody except for Brittany Griner's got dirt under their fingernails.
Dave Zirin, what do you say to people that put forth this argument? She should have known better when she went over there to Russia to not have marijuana on her. You know, she should know the rules. You hear people wag their finger and point that out. And she needs to hence pay the price. How do you make sense of that?
To that I say, well, congratulations. You just made a central plank support for the war on drugs. And what do you think of the war on drugs? What do you think of what it's done to communities across this country? What do you think it's done to people's lives? What do you think it's done on questions of crime, gun violence, gangs, you know, all the residual effects and of versus the investment of billions of dollars in a national security state? That's what the war on drugs is. And by saying, oh, she should have known better because, you know, she said she didn't even pack her own bag, like someone threw a vape cartridge into her bag.
So we should be clear, it was a vape cartridge, so it wasn't like she had bags of weed.
She didn't have a bale of hay in her bag. She had a vape. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, is a vape. And there is no, I mean, you know, for everything that we can say about the U.S. criminal injustice system, I mean, you go into a Russian court, it's a 99% conviction right off the bat. And even by Russian standards, that 9-year prison sentence is above and beyond what you would get for having a vape, even in a country with as repressive drug laws as Russia has. Which is why I've argued since the beginning, you look back like in March, that Brittany Griner needs to be understood as a political prisoner. That's the other thing I would say to the people who are like, well, she broke the drug laws. It's like, do you really think she's in jail because of that vape cartridge? No, this all happened at the start of the Ukraine conflict. It's like, you know, it doesn't take having a PhD in political science to see that this is an act of hostage diplomacy. And in having, really using Griner as a bargaining chip. And if you understand it as a situation involving a political prisoner, all the anti-drug stuff should go out the window because it's an irrelevancy.
How much of this backlash has to do with her taking a stance against the United States because of the very policies I mentioned? Regime change, not convicting police who have often been accused of helping foster some of the proliferation of guns and drugs in our community. Or arresting people disproportionately for having vapes versus, sure, you know, folks who really are peddling, you know, keys and you know, busloads of you know, guns into our community. But how much of the backlash has to do with her taking a stand and refusing to pledge the way that Kaepernick did, or the fact that she is gay? You know, how much of that, or a woman, you know, so how do those factor into, you know, this backlash and this outrage?
Well, that's what's so revealing about this, about the American character, about the character of the right wing, is the mere fact of, first of all, of her existence is an affront to them as a black queer woman with a wife. And then when you factor in the politics of the fact that she took a knee It's like they are apoplectic about this because they don't want her in this country. They don't want her in the country that she was born in. And that is so revealing about who some people think this country is for and who they think it's not for. They don't think it's for Brittany Griner, and therefore, why would you trade anybody for her, of all people? And I think that's reflected itself in the sports coverage of this as well, because it's reflected the invisibility with which the WNBA is treated on the sports landscape. This idea of, okay, this isn't a big story, this isn't a central story, but you know, if Steph was facing 9 years in the gulag, I mean, there would be a tornado of a cacophony that would rise from all four corners of the globe.
As I was coming into the studio, Dave Zirin, I was listening to a couple of the sports radio shows here in the Bay. And you know what the topic has been for the past, you know, most of the morning? It's been Aaron Judge not going to the San Francisco Giants. And who can the San Francisco Giants get to have star power? That's been the discussion most of the morning. Not even the World Cup. None of that. Brittany has not been mentioned on two stations that I listened to. Maybe at the beginning of the morning, I missed it in the beginning, but I was very curious before I reached out to you, you know, to see how they would play out. So it's almost like a non-story. Now, of course, you know, she's going to be, you know, been covered by a lot of the mainstream. But to your point about invisibility, at a place where she should absolutely be discussed, it's been silent. And that's a decision and a choice.
Yeah, I mean, you said it 1,000%, David D. I mean, this it's silence, it's erasure, and it makes this a political fight that I think everyone should have engaged in. And that's one of my critiques. You raise this, like, about people raising, you know, well, the drugs and whatnot. You know, I don't know about you, but I've heard other people say, why are we worried about her when prisons are so terrible here? And it's like, it's not to say that prisons aren't terrible here. It is, though, to have a global perspective on what is prison abolitionism and what is the war on drugs, and not see one as a distraction from the other.
We've been talking with Dave Zirin about Brittany Griner, who has just been freed after, you know, we've been covering this story since early part of the year, when she was detained and then arrested and then given 9 years in a Russian prison, where at the last accounts we heard that she was facing some very harsh treatment inside this prison, probably disproportionate to her crime. But the fact that she was black queer was playing into the harsh treatment that she was getting from both guards and fellow inmates.
Well, the reputation of these prisons is unbelievable, I mean, in the scope of their brutality. And I feel like I have to say this every time, is that that's not to say prisons here are not brutal. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying that. But what she would have to deal with there, I mean, is demonic, the situation she would have been in if this had been her life for the next 9 years. I mean, no contact with the outside world. No even knowledge if the bed could fit her 6'8" frame. No idea if she would have any access to medical care whatsoever, because reports are that there is no medical care in these supermax prisons in Mordovia. And then everything else you mentioned about being a target, about the racism and, of course, anti-Americanism in these jails. I mean, her inability to communicate with other people because of the lack of a common language. I mean, this... you can imagine the hell this would have been. And so for her to come home right now, just in time for the holidays, I mean, it'll be a Brittany Griner Christmas in this house.
Right, and that's a testament to the work that so many activists and, you know, her wife, people like yourself who kept the drumbeat going and writing columns and helping bring attention, you know, kind of made the government, you know, this president has to kind of look and say, let me make this move. I think had there not been a movement, this would not have happened.
much agreement on that front. It's a vindication of agitation.
And
understanding that we can't leave these things to the diplomats. You know, these have to be people-powered movements.
Let me ask you this, Dave. I know your time is short, so I just want to, I have to ask you this, because you talked about invisibility and what's being talked about and what hasn't been. Let's talk about, you know, if we can switch gears for a second, talk about football and a certain individual by the name of Jerry Jones, owner of the Dallas Cowboys. That has almost been a non-topic in many spaces where the NFL is aired and shown and you know, and a main entree, you know, sports talk and all that. Even as LeBron James has raised the question about, if you're going to talk about Kyrie, why aren't we talking about Jerry Jones being pictured in a photograph where you saw white supremacists detaining and not allowing black students to come into the school? What is your take on that? How should we be contextualizing this in 2022? Do you buy the argument that this was so long ago and he's a different person?
No,
he was only 14.
Yeah, Davey, it's because there's continuity between the act of being effectively part of a white race riot, Klan rally without the hoods as a teenager. Fast forward to his crackdown on protesting players. Like, tell me who the black head coach has ever been in Dallas. I mean, it's an atmosphere that has been replicated through his actions as a very powerful NFL owner. That's what gives it relevance to me. And also, it's about memory. And has he reckoned with this? And what does he have to, like, the fact that he doesn't even have to answer for it is infuriating and such an expression of all the privileges that a man like Jerry Jones would enjoy.
If he had been accused of raping somebody, do you feel that he would have to answer for that, or that people would demand that he answer for that crime that he did when he was 14? And the reason why I'm asking that is, and I don't like to, you know, say one crime is worse than the other, but at that time, we're talking about people who were beaten, people whose lives were threatened, and in some cases, people who were killed as they tried to desegregate schools and other places, where mobs like the one that he was shown being pictured in were the catalyst for those types of heinous crimes. Many of those folks went unpunished years after the fact, even as we knew their names. The people that were maybe arrested in some instances were set free by all white juries, and it's almost been swept under the rug. And to your point about continuity, what I couldn't help but think was his political actions and who he has supported over the years. You know, in a state like Texas, he's supporting politicians with his money who are actually fighting and putting policies in place that would take us back to the very conditions and scenarios that he was actually a part of. You know, the segregationist type of era. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. Top to bottom. That's the way I see it. It's about continuity. And that's what makes it worth answering for on top of everything else.
Last question. You know, you had your documentary Behind the Shield. Would this have been included in that documentary?
Oh, in a heartbeat. I mean, we just did a big showing of it last night. Amherst Movie House had a couple hundred people come out. It was awesome. And the first thing I said at the top was, toughest thing about doing this was when we had to step away from it. Because we just slipped in what was happening with Brian Flores at the last second. And it's like, of course, Jerry Jones, that kind of continuity. Oh, that's a story arc right there. So absolutely that would be included because it reveals so much.
Real talk. Dave Zirin, I know you got to go. We appreciate you breaking this down about Brittany Griner. Appreciate your comments about Jerry Jones. And we will be on the lookout for your column, Edge of Sports, and for the radio show you and Eitan Thomas do, you know, The Collision, the intersection of sports and politics.
Yo, thank you so much, Davey. It's real talk from me, too.
Peace out.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
3, 2, 1. Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Once again, returning to our airwaves, good friend of the show, as we continue our ongoing discussions, education of the black child and beyond. We have Hadari Davis from Equity Entertainment and Equity. And we're also joined by Cheryl Davis, who is with the Human Rights Commission. So there's a lot to talk about, and I'm going to start off with you, Hadari, so you can lay the groundwork.
Yeah, well, we have another event coming up. This one, Freedom Dreaming Futures. It's a free conversation about the future of Black people. Our special guest is Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of Beautiful Struggle, We Were 8 Years in Power, The Water Dancer, and of course, Between the World and Me. We'll be talking about his vision for the future of anti-Blackness and institutional racism. This conversation is a free conversation that will be happening online at edutainmentforequity.com. And you can register either via Eventbrite or on our website to get access to the conversation. It's going to be a dialogue about the future, a conversation about future possibility, an analysis of what's happening now and how the things that are happening now impact that future. And it's a conversation that's sponsored by the San Francisco Human Rights Commission, specifically in relation to the Dreamkeeper Initiative and sort of the conversation about reparations, the conversation about equity and restoring justice to the people of the Black people in particular of San Francisco, and really to all people of San Francisco, because when our people are right, all people are right. But maybe Dr. Cheryl Davis, you want to share a little bit about the Human Rights Commission and the Dreamkeeper Initiative.
Sure. Good day to all the folks. Davey D, thank you for this opportunity to share, and Hadari for the ability to partner. I would say, first and foremost, the Human Rights Commission actually started in response to civil unrest that was happening in the 50s and 60s across the nation, specifically around Black folks. So it got its impetus to start because they didn't want to have Black folks be served in restaurants. They didn't want to sell them Cadillacs. They didn't want to have them in the hotels. And so the commission was started really born out of that. And then again, civil unrest, George Floyd, when everybody was making commitments around the nation to do better by Black folks, Mayor London Breed and the president of the Board of Supervisors at that time, Shimon Walton, said, okay, we're going to earmark, we're going to allocate, we're going to pull together $60 million, and we're going to let Black folks in San Francisco decide how they want that money to be used. And so the Dreamkeeper Initiative is a $60 million a year allocation of funds that goes towards initiatives created and led by Black folks for Black folks in San Francisco. And so super excited about the series that Edutainment Equity, you know, has been leading. Edutainment for Equity has been leading and pushing and doing, because so often the thought leaders that are doing this work around the country are inaccessible, and they've made it possible for us to have them, you know, kind of hone in and zone in on San Francisco. With less than 6% of the population being Black, sometimes folks forget that there are Black people here.
Right.
And their stories need to be told, and they need to be celebrated as well.
You know, Cheryl, as you were talking last week, we had Black C from the RBL Posse have the new book out that talks about the life that he experienced. It's his autobiography, growing up in Hunters Point. And I remember when we had him on, well, first of all, in his book, they start off by talking about the migration. You know, he talked about how his parents came from Texas and what it was like living in Hunters Point and et cetera, et cetera. And when we were talking, I was saying, gosh, it's like I'm reading this book about you growing up in the 70s, and it's making me think of this documentary that was made in the 60s by James Baldwin. And, you know, there seems to be maybe a 10-year gap between when he made that documentary and when your parents come to San Francisco. And the systemic problems that was highlighted in, I think, what is it called? Take This Hammer, I believe it was the name of it. Nothing had changed. So now we're fast forwarding, and I'm reading chapter after chapter. He's going through the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, you know, all the way to 2000s. And you're saying to yourself, what has changed for Black folks in San Francisco? And he was talking, you know, talking about that it's always been this struggle, that folks have been completely abandoned and overlooked, and you almost forget that people are here, even though the imprint of Black individuals is something that has come to define the city, whether it's like a Willie Brown or whether it's cultural figures like your Danny Glovers or, you know, the landmark strikes that took place at San Francisco State. You know, there's been some dynamic things that have shaped the country, and yet we still forget, and we have this thing of being overlooked. So I'm just kind of painting that picture, because one of the things that is also, I think, noteworthy is just this discussion around reparations, you know, kind of coming out of San Francisco, the place with less than 3%. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of when we launched the Dreamkeeper Initiative, one of the things that we did is we had like 60 community meetings to get feedback from folks, right? And you're hitting on all of these points in terms of why we need to really focus on reparations and repairing the harm. When we look at the gentrification that comes up, you know, one line that I like to quote from Baldwin is him saying they called it urban renewal, but he said it looked like Negro removal, right? And this idea of pushing folks out because you didn't need them anymore. They came in because folks were gone to war. They came to run the shipyards and to keep the city working. And then when folks came back from war, they wanted the Black folks to go back to the South. And as such, you know, they labeled their neighborhoods as blight. They pushed them out. They, you know, there's a certificate of preference. There's 10,000 plus names on this list of folks who were displaced because of redevelopment. And I believe like some ridiculous number, like 90% of them were Black. So, you know, there's a case for reparations that's just right there, where we don't even have to worry about 209, because if you just say everybody that got a certificate of preference, you know, you're already going to be overwhelmingly working with a Black population. But we've seen it with the consent decree for the school district, where again, young folks were disproportionately impacted in education. We see it where Black students are disproportionately put into special ed classes, so much to the point where the state and the federal government had to come in and say, here's some extra money to fix that, to do right. So it's a constant ongoing conversation. And folks may say, well, California wasn't a slave state, but it didn't hold, but it returned slaves back to slave states.
Yeah, people forget that.
You know, like they were complicit in the act of slavery as well. And then when we go on to, we maybe didn't have anti-literacy laws for Black folks, but we've done everything within our power as a institution, as a government, to actually make it almost impossible for Black folks to learn and to be successful in this state. And San Francisco has some of the same challenges. So, you know, once the unrest, civil unrest happened with George Floyd, it just became really clear and evident that San Francisco could not, there is no progressive state, there is no progressive city that has avoided doing wrong by Black folks.
Right. It's a tale of two cities. It's progressive for everybody but Black folks in many ways. Let me ask you this. As you were talking and you talked about these certificates of displacement, I kept thinking about, you know, how our Japanese brothers and sisters, you know, this was ground zero for them being displaced and, you know, homes taken and the whole nine. Eventually, there was an attempt to make them whole. You know, there was a reparation situation for them. There was rampant discrimination amongst, you know, our Chinese brothers and sisters, you know, the same type of Jim Crow, and their attempts to make them whole as well. This is the first time that Black folks are, there's an attempt to make Black people whole with reparations, the proposals and committees that are happening.
In San Francisco, yes, but you know, there's H.R. 40 on the national level, which has been, right, much like the anti-lynching laws, has come back in all these different forms and iterations. Conyers introduced it decades ago. Sheila Jackson Lee has picked it up. But in San Francisco, the fight has been, in the truest sense, it's been to talk about reparations, but it's been very narrowly focused on the folks that were displaced or what's happening in schools or what's happening in communities. But this will be the first very intentional to say and document, like the harms have been documented before, but we've never come back and said there's a cost for that and here's how much you should give.
You know, I've been to meetings in the city with folks that sit in these governmental chairs, and they've often bragged, don't come to the city and ask for thousands, ask for millions, because our budgets are in the billions, right? You know, that's kind of like, to paraphrase the quote, San Francisco is a very wealthy city. It seems like it would be pretty simple to do minimal things, make sure every Black student has free education. You know, there was an attempt to make education free at City College. And one would say, well, gosh, looking at the price and teaching over at State and seeing what these students have to go through, why not make it free for them? And if you add up the numbers, this is pretty minimal. You know, it's not a lot of money, but it always seems to be a lot of hesitancy. And from your position at the Civil Rights Commission, Who's blocking this? Why won't they just go, you know what, let's just take care of these folks and you know, and at least get the ball rolling? I mean, is it a person? Is it a group of people? Is there, you know, some procedures in place, you know, just to do minimal, as I just described?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I was talking to somebody the other day, like our go-to phrase is, oh, it's the system, right? But the system is made up of people. And so the challenge here is, you know, there are a lot of things at play that keep us from doing that. First and foremost, battling with each other about like how we want it to roll out, right? Whether we want cash disbursements or whether we want to fix the pyramid or the hierarchical structure that was made to keep certain folks on the bottom. And as Thomas Jefferson said, and to rake a few from the rubbish to let them come to the top, right? Mm-hmm. Like the way that the actual institution and system is set up is to keep certain folks at the bottom to help society function and run. And so for those folks who are like, oh, I don't want to invest in education, just give me money. Well, that doesn't necessarily fix the perpetual problem that we're in, because if you get the money and you use it how you want, which you should be able to, you may use it for something that isn't going to actually help you be able to move up this ladder. So there's one fight that's about the internal piece. The other piece is around how we define, and so how the structure has been defined to decide what education or what quality education looks like. And so it erases the cultural wealth, it erases the cultural capital, it erases the innovation and ingenuity that exists within. I just had this debate with somebody the other day who was talking to me about math and science and you know, some folks that are squeegeeing in Boston, and they're trying to address these young people that are like running up to cars and making money to squeegee. And I was like, but if they were doing a lemonade stand, we wouldn't be like, oh, they need a permit for the sidewalk and they need, right, a permit for the lemonade, right? But we'd be like, oh, let me support them and let me help them channel that money into their own entrepreneurial endeavors. And we're not doing the same thing with our young Black innovative young folk, because it doesn't fit into the mold. And so we got to do more to push back on that strategy, and we've just got to be more collaborative in some of the work that we're doing, instead of being picked off, as we can see what's happening in Georgia, you know, where we're being pitted against each other about, you know, being tokenized in some way. And that also contributes to the kind of just disillusion of like what it is that we're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember San Francisco's role in the country as a place of innovation. And so this is no different. It's a place where a new idea is sparked and actually some resources are put behind it. And some really intelligent people are leading the initiative to make it stick with community and to really have kind of loving and compassionate conversations, finding out where people are, what the historical struggle has meant to their real lives, to their current lives. And I think our conversation with Ta-Nehisi is really about the future. So it's about not just the apocalyptic future possibility of what if we don't get reparations, but also examining and kind of exploring, what if we do get them? Like, what if we get everything we want? Do we know how to handle that? Do we understand what things are going to be uncovered? Do we know who our foes are? Are we aware of the systems and kind of processes that will be in place to limit our growth, even within the systems of reparations? And part of what Dr. Davis just pointed out, kind of the internal bickering over who and how and where, or, you know, policy issues about, you know, how resources should be dispersed or who should have the opportunity to do X, Y, or Z. Like, all of these things are part of future possibility. It's all something that we could control within our own frame of conversation. We can come together and put our ideas on one page rather than having 1,000 different pages and everybody asking for a different thing. And so I think a big part of the Human Rights Commission sponsoring this conversation and Edutainment for Equity hosting it is really to try to put everyone on the same page with regard to what the future of Black people could look like, especially in the Bay Area, moving into the next 5, 10, 15 years.
Hadari, if we get ready to wrap up, can you tell people how they can tap in with this conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates? And, you know, and I think you answered my first question as to what he would be focusing on with respect to, you know, to reparations. But how can we tap in and peep them?
So our event is Thursday, 11:30 to 1 o'clock. It will be a conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates about the future of institutional racism and anti-Blackness. The conversation is happening at edutainmentforequity.com. It will also be streamed on the Dream Keeper Facebook page, so you can access it through Facebook as well. It's an hour and a half. So there's some insight that you provided, Davey, from some folks around the community who are talking about this particular issue and kind of helping ground the conversation into in the local perspective. We have president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Shimon Walton, who's also making a presentation kind of explaining what the Dream Keeper Initiative is, what it's for, and what the hopes are for what it can accomplish in San Francisco. And then we have a special like guest artist performance from Latoya London from American Idol. So she'll do, we have like a short artistic break for her to share some of her work. So, you know, but this whole event really is designed to get people thinking about the future and really to think about what the possibilities are for dismantling institutional racism, what the possibilities are for actually addressing anti-Blackness. And reparations is part of that conversation, but it's not the whole of it, because these issues like institutional race, structural racism, they impact us whether we get reparations or not. Like, just because we get reparations doesn't mean these systems that have been built and maintained for hundreds of years are just going to crumble around us. And so a big part of that conversation is, how do we dismantle those systems? What do we do not only with our financial resources, but what do we do with our minds, you know, with our education? What do we do with our education to really put ourselves in a position to dismantle the systems that have been designed to destroy us or displace us?
Well, that also answers another question, which I was going to direct as we wrap up, because it definitely, there's a lot of education that needs to go on. You know, I often think about professional athletes who, you know, come out of dire straits and they get, you know, a big check. Or, you know, where I'm more familiar with the music industry, they get that big first check. And, you know, there's a lot of predators there. Literally, yeah. There's the jeweler that's sitting there saying, you can get, you know, you just signed a contract, you need to get this, you know, $1 million worth of jewelry to put around your neck. And there's somebody else that wants them to invest in some sort of shady financial dealing that then goes, you know, belly up, and then somebody else comes along and then will use, you know, rhetoric like black power rhetoric. Brother, if you're really about the community, you'll give us all this money, and then they disappear. And if you don't have your wits and understanding and you're not anchored, you know, you can literally, as we've seen over the years, have $1 million and it be gone within a couple of minutes.
So then it's just, so that's just the kind of, it speaks to the lack of a trusted institution or the lack of like trusted voices.
Well, trusted, let me push back. Let me push back on that.
All the resource and actually distribute in a way that is consistent with the needs of the people. But go ahead.
Let me push back on that, because it's more than that. You have to have the understanding, because we had trusted people come up to us all throughout the early 2000s and tell us to get jumbo loans and buy a house. Right. I mean, I can name them, you know. Yeah. They had big panels. They were on TV. They were showing up at our churches. And if people think I'm exaggerating, you could look at a book called Prophecy, a Prosperity Gospel. I'm going to remember the sister's name. She talks about the collusion that went on. She was one of those preachers. Say, you know, let's come to the church, and then really gaslight people and say, if your loan went belly up, it was a lack of faith. And then on, you know, and outside of that institution, you had other individuals who were cultural icons that literally came in and said, you know, get a loan. And they were backed by your Wells Fargo and your Walmarts and all that. And at the end of the day, $93 billion left our community, mm-hmm. right? And most of us were told, I could trust you, Hadari. I could trust Cheryl. I could trust Dave. And half the time, we didn't know what we were doing, or we were in collusion with somebody else. And so to me, after seeing that, we definitely have to have education, so you can't get fooled even by those who we should in theory trust.
I was going to say, I remember having this conversation with some folks, including John Burris at one point in time, and he was sharing this story about how he helps these folks get this money, you know, and they get these lump sums, and he was adamant that he felt like the education piece was really important, because he had some very extreme hard stories where folks got money, they went out and bought a fast car, and they wrecked and like not just lost the car but lost their lives. And he was like, mm-hmm. he felt like he, when he helps people win these cases, he needs to do a little bit more, because it's not as simple as giving folks the money. Mm-hmm. And I know everybody's like, you know, do what they want to with the money, but sometimes they don't know what, to your point, David, like they don't know what to do with the money, you know. And that's something that we've learned, even with just the $60 million from the Dream Keeper Initiative. Folks are like, some people can't, we say, oh, if they gave me that money, I would spend. People can't even spend it down sometimes. They get right. the money, they're like, I got 6 months to spend $200,000, and I got to have receipts, and I got to do this, and I got, and they're like, I can't even get the money out the door.
Or even as we saw during the .com, you know, the first .com, where people were coming in and they were like, just, you know, instead of getting cash, why don't you get it in what's the word, shares, right? Remember that? And there was quite a few black folks that got shares in startups, and nobody ever educated them that you got to pay taxes on those shares. Mm-hmm. So what happened when the .com went bellied up? People were owing $1 million worth of taxes. Same thing with homes, you know. I mean, it's all those different types of things that you know, we can call them life skills. They're certainly not taught in school. And, you know, and we got to learn them. A lot of times we learn them the hard way. You know, we've done way too many shows with just the elderly who have lost their houses because of just, you know, maybe missing literally a decibel on their tax returns. And, you know, so to your point, Hadari, it's definitely, we got to have some trusted institutions, but we also got to have that education so we can understand who we should be trusting and who we shouldn't.
Yeah, and I think part of that trust is the educators. You know, like part of that is trusting that you're going to get the right advice, that there's really intelligent people who are building systems to actually counter the systems that have been oppressing our lives. But we have to remember that the folks who built this institutional racism, these structural systems, the folks who did that planned. They sat in meetings and they talked. They organized. They had PowerPoint presentations. They made sales. They had a whole structure. They had strategic plans that stretched out into years beyond the lives of the people who were in the room. And so we've got to be those kinds of strategic thinkers about the future. We can't, there's a lot about the past that we have to uncover because it's been hidden from us, it's been buried. There's a lot about our current reality that we know intuitively, but we don't know factually. Like, we can't come and present the data and say, this is how many is this, or this is how many is that. So there's definitely some things in the past and the present that need to be uncovered and clarified. But if we don't sit down as trusted people and strategically think about the future and how the future is going to play out, then we're going to be the subject to other people's futures, not futures that are directed by our own.
And to your point, there are people that are definitely planning. Hey, if they get some reparations and they get a check, or if they get reparations and they get to go to a school, you know, how can we pimp that?
That's
And you know, and I'll leave it with this. There's a video. It may still be online, but somebody leaked the video from Pabst Brewing Company. It about 10 years ago was when the I want to say it was Loco. They had some sort of high alcohol drink that came out. And what I remember was they had this meeting. There was no black people in this meeting. The president came up and he said, "We don't drink this. My kids don't drink this, but they do in the hood." And they talked about how they were going to hire Snoop to be a spokesperson, which he was. And then they talked about how they were going to go and give free, free samples, you know, meaning cases, to popular urban radio DJs, and then invite them and have them fly into these parties and resorts. But they had it all planned, and it was basically like, once we get Snoop on board, you know, then we're going to, you know, and get these other radio DJs from these stations on board, we're going to make a killing. And it was like, and the whole time they're laughing that they don't drink it, you know. And so to your point, you know, strategic, long-term plan, profit. They had a PowerPoint, like you said. They had numbers, and they had marketing.
Marketing and great language. And that's something that, you know, our local, I mean, edutainment for equity, we spend a lot of time like looking at what's happening outside of the equity field, looking what's happening outside of the education field, and trying to bring some of that in. And some of it is just like entertainment, right?
Yeah.
But strategically thinking about a marketing plan for reparations is similar to strategically thinking about a marketing plan for a high alcoholic beverage. You know, we need the same type of strategy. We need the same type of serious people who have clear vision. And Ta-Nehisi is one of those people, right? This is a person who hasn't just written about the past and the present, but even in his latest book, in this fictional book, he's in this speculative fiction world now. Even though he's looking at the past, it's still very like speculative and allegorical to the things that are happening to us in our community today. So,
right.
You know, Ta-Nehisi is one of those voices that can galvanize people, that can bring people together, help create some shared language, and create space for us to have the kind of marketing plan that's going to put people on the same page. And so this is the part, right? This is the pre-work that you do to get people to dream freedom futures, right? To
Real
not
talk.
Dream apocalyptic futures, but to dream possibility. So this is just the kind of an initial way to get people to think about, well, what if we did have? What if this didn't exist? Or what if this obstacle was not in front of me? Or what if I could overcome it and had the resources to do it? That's kind of the exploration that we need to do.
Get people in the habit. As we close out, Cheryl Davis, Dr. Cheryl Davis, I'm going to let you get the last words. Anything you want to add, or let us know about the, you know, San Francisco Human Rights Commission, and, you know, how we can tap in and support the work that you've been doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm energized by this conversation. And I would say, you know, to building on what Hadari said, what I believe the Dream Keeper Initiative has done is given us the ability to start to do this freedom dreaming futures, right? Like that we're literally pulling in dollars and letting folks think through like what they would want to do with it, and not put not put boundaries on them, right? Not put parameters on them. And what we've seen is, you know, an old, like one of my favorite is an old check cashing store in the Fillmore in what was known as the Harlem of the West is now this like incubator store called In the Black, which has 20 plus black businesses in there setting up shops, selling their wares in a place that used to basically take money from black folks, now generating revenue for black folks, or seeing the down payment assistance program that was not working, the general one, be repurposed and be intentional and give more money to black folks. And in a space where we saw 5 black people go through a program in 5 years, now we see 18 people go through it, 18 black folks in 1 year. Like the potential, like it's giving us the ability to dream and to realize that when we invest in those dreams, that when we invest in black people, that we can really do things that folks told us were impossible. So I'm excited about listening to Ta-Nehisi like talk about that, because I think dreamers are what we need. What the system has done is work to take the dreams away from folks. And as Langston Hughes said, you know, hold fast to dreams, because if they go, right, life is a barren field frozen with snow. So basically, we have to plant the seeds of dreaming and hoping and watch them bear their fruits. So I'm excited about the investment that we've made in San Francisco and the mistakes that we'll make that we can learn from. And I think that if we say that it has to be perfect, then we set ourselves up for failure. And tech companies and science is all about learning from their failures. And
that's right.
I want to just be able to like mess up and learn from that and come back stronger.
Right. And black folks should be afforded the opportunity to not be perfect from time to time, you know, because we definitely let everybody else, you know, figure it out. Dr. Cheryl Davis, thank you very much. How can people get a hold of you all at the Human Rights Commission?
It is, you can find us on Facebook at San Francisco Human Rights Commission. And then we are sf-hrc.org, I think.
There you go, sf-hrc. That stands for Human Rights Commission, folks.
So yeah, so Thursday, December 8th, 11:30 to 1 p.m. at edutainmentforequity.com. That's edutainment like KRS-One's, edutainmentforequity.com. This event is a free virtual conversation with the legendary author, writer, thinker, and freedom dreamer, Ta-Nehisi Coates. We're encouraging everybody to buy his books. You got to go buy his books. Go read his books, The Beautiful Struggle, The Water Dancer, Between the World and Me, and We Were 8 Years in Power. Read this man's books. He's the James Baldwin of our time. We feel very honored to be able to host him in this conversation and really talk about issues that are relevant to black people in the Bay Area. So we look forward to seeing you all at this event.
Don't forget he did the Panther comics too.
He did the Black Panther. He's writing the Captain America comic right now. He wrote the Black Panther series for a while, like, and this is the other part of Ta-Nehisi Coates, and it's kind of like W.E.B. Du Bois, right? He's known for his 84 books of history and sociology, and but he also wrote poems, and he also wrote love songs, and he also wrote science fiction stories, and he's not necessarily known as much for that. Well, here we have Ta-Nehisi, who's famous for these essays that he's written, these long book form essays about our current reality and Barack Obama and reparations, etc. But then he's got his latest book, and the comic books are really in the speculative Afrofuturist space.
Right.
So that's what we're trying to tap into a little bit in this conversation, trying to bring some of that imagination and that creativity and that dreaming into the space where we're really talking about really serious issues that impact our people.
Hadara Davis, Dr. Cheryl Davis, thank you very much. We're going to bounce on out of here on Hard Knock Radio. See you all on Thursday. Peace for now.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah.
Stand up. Ensemble Big Now Woos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bellevue. seem obvious, but they are not when they ain't gone all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee. Hating that they made they peace, trying to eat it and any from the steel grave, you say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread, making a speech. Say peace to their lovers, I neighbor to please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. You go, hey, it ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio, you are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast.
Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at